Welcome to the Agile Revolution podcast. This is Craig, and this is an interview that Renee and I had with Elan Goldstein at the recent Agile Australia 2012 conference in Melbourne. Elan is a Scrum Master, he's the director at Axis Agile, and he's the author of the very popular blog and upcoming book in the Mike Cohen signature series of the same name called Scrum Shortcuts Without Cutting Corners. Now, unfortunately, when we met with Elan, we had a couple of technical difficulties. We're missing the last few minutes of our discussion, but it's a great one nonetheless. So I'll be back at the end just to give you a couple of the links. But in the meantime, adjust your earphones, get comfortable, and enjoy the discussion.
Welcome to the Agile Revolution podcast. We are live at Agile Australia 2012. With me, I have my co-host, Craig Smith.
Hey, Renee, how you doing?
And we have a special guest, Elan Goldstein.
Goldstein, that's right, yes.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Back to Australia.
Thank you, yes.
So where have you been?
Wow, where did we start? So first stop, it was Singapore. I was doing some co-training with Pete Diemer over there. He's the co-author of the Scrum Primer that you may have read. From there, we went to the States. I did some co-training with Kenny Rubin up at Redmond at Microsoft. That was very interesting. And then across the country down to Atlanta for the Scrum Gathering, which was really...
We'll ask you a bit more about that a bit later, I think.
Sure. That was an interesting event. And then off to London, I did some co-training with Gabby Benfield out there before returning via Hong Kong. I mucked my flights up, so I ended up having 2 hours in Sydney before coming down to Melbourne. So here I am, recovering from jet lag.
I was watching your Twitter feed with great concern, because I was going, he's still in Hong Kong. Oh,
yeah,
my
yeah.
goodness.
Yeah.
I'm
yeah.
not going to make it.
Yeah, yeah.
So we know you, but for our listeners, what's the one-minute story, the Elan story?
The one-minute, I'll talk about the one-minute Agile story of mine. So, look, I got into Agile about, really started playing with Agile stuff about 10 years ago, really with some XP stuff, some pair programming, old school index cards, etc. And then I really started fine-tuning this and heading towards Scrum, about 5 years ago. And I really, as I said yesterday, I'm a Scrum guy. I'm very open-minded, but at heart, I'm a Scrum guy. And, at the end of last year, I started blogging about Scrum, and I was very fortunate at the end of last year to have the blog picked up by Mike Cohen, who invited me to write as part of his signature series. And more recently, as I just mentioned, I went on my own sort of Scrum pilgrimage around the world. I'm very much about knowledge acquisition and learning at the moment. There's a hell of a lot to learn, and that's what I'm really about at the moment, just trying to suck in as much information from as many experts as possible.
I think the learning thing for me is quite interesting. I'm trying to battle in my head about how far as a coaching community we are meant to learn and how far we're meant to push others to learn. I'm very much aware that, for example, developers are spending a lot of their time refining their own tactics on how to develop new architectures, new languages and so forth, and yet we keep on pushing other information onto them. Is that a concern that you think about?
Yes, I think that there can, especially in our Agile space, and I think I've got a concern that we're getting overloaded with all different frameworks right now, almost flavors of the month. And as coaches and as those on that sort of cutting edge, we're trying to suck in all this information, and our natural instinct is to try and push it out. And we have to be cognizant of the fact that while we might be ready for this information and to try these different approaches, the people we're coaching, we need to sort of go a bit more slowly and bed things down a bit more. So I think it's a really good point, actually.
Yeah, and I agree with that point. And I just wonder also whether, whilst we're on this learning journey, we're also bringing so many other things in. You said 10 years ago, we were, if it wasn't a post-it note or a story card or a Sharpie, we didn't really want to know about it. And now we're bringing in leadership and management theory and marketing, systems thinking, and then all the non-IT stuff. Yeah. And as especially as IT folks have driven this, so we kind of going too far.
And we need to keep it simple, but more importantly, practical. And that, and really, that was my concern, and that's why I started the blog, because I think it's very easy to get sucked into the theory. It all sounds great, but the actual, as you guys are well aware, the actual conversion of that theory into real life practice is very difficult.
I think that's the thing I love about your blog, as a self-professed reader, is that it's from the trenches, right? It's not something you've read in a book somewhere. It's real life stuff.
And that's what I think it's about, and that's why I think I was so fortunate to have it picked up, because a lot of the literature out there is coming from a more theoretical perspective. And as I said, it's a concern of mine that for this movement to continue, we have to be delivering results, and to deliver results, we must be practical, and theory will only get us so far. It gets us over the cell, but then the longevity of this has to be practical. So
let me ask you a question, because this is something I've been trying to prompt people here at the conference about, is to share their learning. So what was it that made you decide that you're working in a team somewhere and to actually start sharing the knowledge? Like what, Fiona Wood prompted us yesterday, get up in the morning and be better every day. What was the thing that drove you to write this stuff down, and probably thinking that anyone even care about it when you started writing it?
Yes, I've been asked that a few times, and the answer is essentially I was getting a lot of questions from colleagues, both internally from where I was working, as well as a lot of other colleagues who I'd worked with in the past, who I might have introduced Scrum to and are now leading their own teams, and are finding these new hairy situations that, they're not textbook. They need tweaks. And to be honest, I was getting a lot of these questions, and it was I just thought, let's leverage this.
There's obviously no answers out there. And I need to provide them
and save myself some time. Let's put it in a central spot and let others try and help as many people as possible, and let others help each other as well. Obviously, blogs are very interactive, and I think that's what it's doing. So
the blog is scrumshortcuts.com?
That's correct. And as we're talking about, it's a practical approach to the various Scrum practices, and it's an interesting situation, and you guys will be well aware of this as well, that Scrum's a framework, all the Agile, the cousins of frameworks as well. And my concern when writing this, how much I'm trying to help, I am concerned that it will be seen as a prescribed set of rules. So that's what I'm very cognizant about, and something I need to communicate very clearly with the book, that this isn't a one size fit all situation.
So
this
big letters on the first page, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, maybe you can give me some feedback on that, because
Henrik Nyberg does that very much in his first page. It's sort of, this is how
he does.
You can use it this way, or you can just adapt it for what you need, but this is not the rule book on it.
Yeah, no, he does. And Martin Kearns, actually, when I was speaking to him about it, he gave me a good suggestion. His idea was essentially like a parent, and I spoke about this actually in my talk. You don't want to be a helicopter parent and try and help your kid avoid every situation. However, when they do stumble, you want to guide them. So I've been bruised a lot on my quest to actually get this thing to work properly. Lots of trips and lots of bruises. So if I can maybe help others not get bruised as much, that's what I'm trying to do. So it's a fine line, though, right? Between prescribed and keeping it open and about the journey.
So what's new going forward?
Well, we're in the process of actually establishing a training consulting group called Axis Agile. Essentially, my focus right now is on writing the book. I want to get that draft done in the next few months, so that's my focus. And around that, I'm looking at picking up some coaching and consulting gigs. So that's what I'm doing there. And as I mentioned, I've been touring around, getting information and learning a lot about how the game works. So that's the idea. Bottom line, I really want to dedicate my career to something I'm extremely passionate about, that being Agile and more specifically Scrum.
So will the book have the same name as your blog? Is that correct, or not quite sure yet?
It's a good question. The working title is Scrum Shortcuts Without Cutting Corners.
Yep.
Mike really loves that, Mike Cohen. And he's a series editor, so that's going to have some sway. Publishers will get more heavily involved later down the track, so we'll see what happens.
So who's the ideal audience for the book?
The ideal audience would be a Scrum Master, although I'm keeping it open at this stage. Anyone involved in Scrum, it's targeted at specifically Scrum Masters who have had some experience, whether they've gone to a course, whether they've been practicing.
So they're probably at the shoe layer, starting to get towards that ha layer of questioning why.
Those who want to sort of take things to the next level. It's not an entry level book. There is an assumption that you understand what Scrum is.
So at a minimum, people have done CSM?
Or the equivalent. I don't like to say you must have done a certification. I don't agree with that approach. But that level of knowledge, yes. Yeah.
And it's interesting because the thing I like about this is that there's no real book out there about this. It, you know, surprisingly, I mean, you know, if you think about it being almost the most popular training, you know, course in our community.
Well, 70% coverage,
And there's no real books. Yeah, you know, there's chapters here and there or, you know, sections in books, but no real book that
there's
covers.
There's no definitive, I was going to say guide. Maybe poor choice of words.
I hear what you're saying, though. Yeah, absolutely. That is the frustration and again, prompted me to write the blog, and I want to see this movement live, and without people understanding how to convert this into practice, it won't live. So
what about actually the approach to writing the book? You know, any sort of agile approach to getting there, or are the publishers still a little bit behind in the...
Okay, so the publishers, between you guys and whoever's listening, the publishers.
So just a couple of hundred people, right? Yeah.
We love you, publishers.
To be honest, the publishers get more involved near the tail end, which is a bit more waterfall, so I might suggest they read the book.
That's cultural, right?
That's right.
I'm just thinking where I was going with that is, you know, because we love the publishers. When you're actually writing the book, I mean, obviously you've learned so much about this whole Scrum approach. How can you apply that to something that, you know, as an industry hasn't quite made the length about, and it's not your job to go and change it?
Yeah, no, exactly. And, jokes aside, the publishers have been very helpful. I'm lucky to be part of this signature series, which has a number of authors in it. So as far as interacting with them, that has been a lot more agile, working in small batches. So I'm trying to release batches of 5 short chapters at a time that get reviewed, and so I'm getting that feedback loop happening early. So that is good. What I have been struggling with lately since young Amy was born was...
time?
My velocity.
Yes.
I seem to have had...
Too much work in progress.
Yeah. And a significant impediment, albeit a very cute significant impediment. And Mike actually gave me some great advice. I spoke to him at the Scrum Gathering in Atlanta, and he was saying, look, I wrote my first book when I was in a similar position. He said, what you have to learn is reduce your sprint sizes to 30 minutes. So whenever you have got a small gap, you need to capitalize. Don't wait for those long 3-hour chunks of time. If you get 30 minutes, hit it.
So a little bit Pomodoro type technique.
Exactly right.
We can see Pomodoro. Here, you know, you're sitting here, you've got the laptop half open. As soon as we hit stop on there, I can see another 2 paragraphs are going to get banged out.
Exactly right. So that's the idea.
So tell us a bit more about Atlanta.
Very interesting, and what I was very buoyed coming to this event, because 850 plus in Australia is amazing. I think you guys have done a fabulous job here, because that's significant. Relating back to Atlanta, that's a global Scrum gathering. Don't quote me on the exact numbers, but it was perhaps half the attendance here. Different type of event.
Okay.
I think they try and keep it nice and tight so that they can run more sort of interactive sessions, such as a full open space day, which was really really cool. It was a great event. There were great international speakers there. It was really interesting. It was great to network with you know, non-Aussies who are there. And yeah, Atlanta's a very interesting place with a massive airport. I can tell you that for nothing. So yeah, it was good.
Yeah, and an interesting city. Did you go to the Coke Factory too while you were there?
I was a little late for the tour. It's a significant city. I didn't quite realize. Home of CNN headquarters, Coke headquarters. What was the other one? Home Depot. Yeah, really interesting place.
They often have the Scrum Gathering in Atlanta. Is there any significance behind that, do you think? Or?
Coming back to the airport, I think it's a very easy hub. Place to get to. It's the largest airport, I think, as far as traffic goes in the world. Perhaps that's the reason. I think there's quite a large Scrum community there. Also in Colorado, there's a great deal of Scrum experts coming out of Colorado. So
if you had to pick, you know, one or a couple of things that you really picked from the Scrum Gathering, you know, from all the things you saw, was there anything that stood out as, you know, inspiring for
highlights or messages?
I think. Let me go back there. I'm trying to
rewind the jet lag and the small child.
Yeah, look, I mentioned the open space. I think they did a day open space very, very effectively. It was very self-organizing, yet it was very controlled anarchy. It was a very good.
I find our friends in the US actually tend to do those very well.
Like,
every time I've seen an open space here, it just doesn't quite fit the culture. I was speaking to someone here at this conference about the fact that we have an open space area. It was a bit of a, you know, a bit of a battle to kind of get it there in the first place. It's not big enough, and there's three tables,
but
but to get that there was even a start. But I've just seen over the last couple of days a few people have been starting to see it, and then a few more people sit down.
I agree, and I think culturally, doing this trip, it's very interesting because I think we Aussies tend to be a little bit more conservative. And learning from Atlanta, there's a hell of energy, and an open space works very well. There's a lot of participation. People are willing to put it out there and just...
I mean, I find these days, personally, I get a lot more through one-on-one conversations or just small group conversations than getting information fed through to me. And it's that collaborative effort where we pick up on certain things that people are saying and can extend on it, and everyone actually learns adaptively.
But think about that's exactly what we're striving for in our community, right? It's all those different learning mechanisms. People learn in different ways. I think the interesting thing here in Australia is that if there's a talk on, people have to sort of feel they need to get there, right? So we're actually sitting here in the middle of a session and we're kind of all good that, you know, perhaps we're not at something, but, you know, a lot of the attendees are like, oh, I'd love to do an open space, but...
Well, that's the thing. I think also in Atlanta, a lot of the corridor discussions were really, really important, and a lot of really good ideas get seeded in those corridors. So I think that was great. One comment I did have about that gathering, their sessions were actually 1.5 hours. They were long sessions.
Wow.
I really like the format here. They're short, you know, 30 to 40 minute sessions, punchy. You get through more. You get to see more variety. I think that's a good format. Yeah.
How many streams did they have going at once?
They did have more streams, actually. They used breakout rooms, so smaller sessions. So whereas here, you've got three sessions, you've got several hundred people in each session.
About 300, yeah.
Yeah, they had a number of breakout rooms, maybe six or so, which were... And you had far fewer people in there, so they were more interactive sessions. So you could run... more games and more exercises.
So a lot of the workshops here were actually on the first day prior to the conference starting.
That's right. So, yeah, that sort of format was more inherent at the Scrum Gathering.
Yeah. I wonder whether that's, that's just a variety thing for, you know, like, it's a different culture thing again, that, you know, they demand more variety there, you know, larger population and things, whereas here I think, you know, we run more than three or four streams at a conference here and people complain they don't get to see everything.
Yeah, exactly. And that is a challenge with these types of conferences. There's so much good stuff that you're going, huh, I'm missing out on this, or I really want to do that. They're simultaneous talks, so it's, we need to work out a way around that. too much good stuff.
So what brought you here in the first place is obviously a talk. You had a talk on Scrum Masters, attitudes and abilities.
Yep, that's right.
And really it came back to servant leadership.
That's right. The reason I put that talk together, again, a little bit out of frustration that I feel that the Scrum Master role and equivalent roles, iteration managers, agile coaches, XP coaches, etc., they're possibly becoming trivialized and they're not being recognized for the deep complexity that that they involve. A servant leader is a very challenging role and it's not a facilitation role only. And that's what I tried to convey in the talk and allow people to appreciate what is actually involved and that not anyone can just jump in and be the Scrum Master, and it's not something you can learn after going to a two-day course.
You talked quite a bit about PMs and their relationship to Scrum Masters and how quite often there's a lot of adverts going out there for a dual role.
That's right. And another frustration is the fact that we seem to, as an industry, feel that there's this natural flow between being an ex-project manager and you move into a Scrum Master role. It's almost a click your fingers, I'm a project manager, now I'm a Scrum Master. And that is
And there are some
incorrect.
Fundamental differences
That's
in the
right.
approaches.
That's
so
right.
just because you are a PM doesn't mean that you're naturally going to be a good
That's
Scrum
right.
Master
That's
and
right.
vice versa.
That's
even.
Right. That's right.
Or the flip side, it's just someone who happens to be good at admin. Right? So you end up being the admin person. I see that as well. Like if it's not the project manager,
sure.
it happens to be the person who happens to want to tidy the cards up in the corner. And...
Sure, absolutely. So I guess in a nutshell, the big point is this role is deep and it requires a certain type of person with a certain type of personality and ethic, and there's no funnel to just take candidates from it. We need to be very open-minded with who should be a servant leader, and they could come from anywhere.
It's an incredibly hard role, in my opinion, to master that balance between knowing when to help advise versus coach, and when to train, teach versus stepping back and letting the team fail.
It's really interesting. It was one of the four abilities I mentioned yesterday, being protective or overprotective. And as you guys know, when you're Scrum Master, you just want to jump in and help your team and clear the impediments. It's really, you're almost waiting for it. And the ability to hold back and just say, hang on a second, let's see how you guys navigate through this. I'll be here to guide you through. If you recall, I was speaking about the wizard, and the Scrum Master needs to see themselves like a wizard. They don't necessarily get involved in the nuts and bolts, but they arrive just at the right time to help the team get through a hairy situation or to give them some advice. And I like that analogy. I can't claim it as original. I got that from Jürgen Apello's Management 3.0. He's talking a bit more broadly with regards to managers, but I think the Scrum Master role is very wizard-like.
Cool. So let me ask you the question I always ask. People talk to me about Scrum Masters. Should a Scrum Master be a full-time role? And if so, what does that really mean?
Ellen did answer this one. You just weren't there for it.
But the listeners don't know.
No, the chapter I'm working on right now is covering this, so I'm going to love your feedback. My answer to this question is I absolutely think it's a full-time role, especially for a new team. A new Scrum team, there is so much education and PR and navigation and setup, and it's huge. It's a huge role. That being said, we have to be realistic, and not every company is going to have the resource to have a full-time Scrum Master for every team. And I've got to speak personally. I've been a Scrum Master for two teams, three teams at a time. However, there are big caveats on this. If you are going to be a Scrum Master for multiple teams, those teams need to be mature, both as Scrum teams, but also they need to be mature technically. They need to have strong test automation in place, for example. And the company culture can't be that It can't be political. If you've got inherent political impediments the whole time, that's a big job for the Scrum Master. So the answer, it depends. Definitely full-time for a new team. Mature teams, yes, you can have some look after more than one team. But I'm just going to babble a little bit more here because it's another important point that I got asked yesterday. Can I be a BA or a developer and a Scrum Master on a team? I would say I would much rather someone be a Scrum Master on multiple teams than a developer and a Scrum Master on the same team. There are too many cross-cutting concerns, and we have to recognize the Scrum Master is a specialist role. It's not just something you can juggle on the side.
So what's your opinion, Craig?
I asked the full-time role one because I think this is one that often gets muddied a bit in the waters, because ultimately you need someone in the team who is always playing that role. But whether they need to be full-time, people see that as, okay, I just need to hire somebody, and they go and get any old person off the street, like the project manager we talked about before, and said, let's put them in the Scrum Master role, and that's a mistake. I'd much prefer to see someone from the team, even if it's a developer,
rise to the occasion,
as opposed to, just a hired gun come in. My view often, though, is that in the company that Ray and I own, we often see people actually hiring for what we call iteration managers in our corporation, but essentially the same thing, at the detriment of going and hiring skilled resources to actually get the job done. And to me, the Scrum Master role is still secondary to a team actually being able to deliver. So I'd much prefer to hire a gun developer and get someone in the team, maybe that person, to actually take that role. But when you do that, and this is where I agree with you on a newly forming team, their ability to develop is zero.
Yep.
Right? Their job is a floater. So I always tell people to go for the skill set first and then go for the Scrum Master later, but you still need someone on the team that can carry that role.
Sure, absolutely. My only concern with the dual role is this cross-cutting concern.
This expectation that, you're a developer, you should be developing rather than spending this time being the Scrum Master. And I think, from my perspective, priority has to be on the Scrum Master elements if you have that dual role.
I think the other thing, though, is, and maybe this is where you were going, is that the cross-cutting thing, maybe that's not such a concern, but what you do find is when a developer is doing the role, development issues tend to take precedence.
That's the concern. Yeah. That's exactly right.
So they're not able to take that hat off.
Yeah. So it needs to be a special kind of person, and that's where you do sometimes struggle with that.
That's right. And it's not black and white. If you do, your point is very, very pertinent. If you've got a special type of person who understands the importance of each role and is able to make very clever trade-off decisions based on what's required by that team at that point in time, no problem. They can do that. It's when you've got someone who finds that challenging, and then what's the priority? The development task that I've been that I've committed to doing, or helping the team through their process and impediment removal, etc.
But certainly, without a doubt, it's highly dependent upon the maturity of the team, and I guess in some respects the risk of the project itself. How big is the team?
Sure, absolutely.
So I actually have a couple of quotes which I loved in particular from your your session. So if you don't mind, if you want to make enemies, try and change something.
That, again, I can't take credit for that. That was
from Woodrow Wilson.
That's Woodrow Wilson, yeah. I love that quote. He said it's so true. It's so true.
And I think the other thing is that this is actually where lots of people have trouble when they go on their Scrum implementation. And as Agile coaches, we get the same thing, right? Is that you kind of got to be friendly and make friends to build trust and things like that. But at the same time, you have to step back and go, you know what? I'm going to make some enemies here. Or I can't
That's
be everybody's
right.
friends because
right.
I'm going to have to tell you some.
And I think I've had that realization in the last couple of weeks when you think about how coaches are measured as far as success, and part of me has realized that us having a measurement of customer satisfaction actually may be wrong in some instances, because sometimes we're there to actually piss people off,
that's right.
to force them to change.
Yeah, they did a crap job, and it was interesting. I was just watching another talk, Colin McCrurick, who here at the conference, who I was a coach in part of his journey, and just watching him up there talk about all these things like, and I implemented this, and we implemented that, and we did quality, and it was so great to see all that happen. But at the same time, it was kind of like, man, the struggles to to get to those things. Right. I mean, he's always been open, but that's when you know you've kind of made a good job, and that's, I think, one of the things that I think people don't really realise when they put that Scrum Master hat on.
I totally agree. You need to agitate, and I said during the talk, if someone were to come to me with no idea about what this Scrum Master thing is, what's the key role? The key role is a change agent. And a change agent needs to educate, needs to sell, needs to make friends, needs to agitate and potentially stir the pot. You know what I mean? So it's change agent. It's a very complicated role, and as Woodrow says, you're going to make enemies along the way.
So would you agree that then the job isn't for everybody?
Absolutely. It's not fair. It's not for everybody. However, we need to be open-minded and understand that great change agents could come from anywhere.
Yep.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So the other one I liked was a comment about silos being too nice of a term, and you referred to them as departmental fortresses.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's coming from experience, and as we know, we need previously siloed off departments to be working really hand in glove now. We need the product guys working with the development guys, and don't know about you, but I've worked in companies where literally it's us and them, and if we can't get that to work, then Scrum is not going to work.
Do you think this comes back to what we were talking about right at the start, though, that we have to remember that people are at different levels of the journey? So I think for us, that's completely obvious to us right now, and probably even some of the organisations we're in, where we've enveloped the development team to be able to deliver that. That's kind of what we expect. That's the next level, is we have to bring the product guys along for the journey. But I assume there's still some part that if you're going into some organisation that's still completely foreign to this, that you sort of start somewhere, and going and tackling the product guys first may not be the best solution.
Yeah, I mean that's what I was talking about yesterday with the change agent. You essentially need to be able to go in and observe the landscape and understand who you're dealing with, who the stakeholders are, what the environment is, what the politics are, and come up with a change plan. And perhaps you start with the product guys, perhaps you don't, perhaps you work on them together, but you have to be able to promote, I feel, not just these broader benefits, but you need to be able to understand each role and be able to show them what their specific benefits are and why this is beneficial and why should they break down these barriers and to build this trust. And I found that to be a real challenge in getting Scrum adoption happening. It's a big challenge.
So going forward, where do you see the future of Agile going?
The short answer is that I think it's extremely exciting, and the growth is phenomenal. I think this conference alone in this country has grown, 25% year on year? Correct me if I'm wrong, which is phenomenal growth.
Yeah, I didn't mention at the start, 8 years ago, there used to be a conference in Australia for Agile, and it had 50 people.
I think it's phenomenal, and I'm in awe of the organisers here. You guys have been involved in this. This is phenomenal. That being said, I'm seeing challenges out there and touring around. I think there is fragmentation going on, especially across the broader Agile community, different movements springing up, and instead of working together and seeing everyone can play nicely, they're sort of trying to challenge each other.
How do we fix that?
You don't have a magic wand? Not right now. Let me have a think about it.
And unfortunately, that's where the $2 part gave out on us. Craig here with you again. Elan pretty much was just wrapping up by giving you some of the links where to find out some more of his details. So if you're interested more about Elan or his company, he is the director at Axis Agile. You can find them on the web at axisagile.com, axisagile.com. If you'd like to read his blog, you can find that at scrumshortcuts.com. And his new book, the same name as the blog, called Scrum Shortcuts Without Cutting Corners. More details on the blog. It's going to be out from Addison Wesley in 2013, and it's part of the Mike Cohen Signature Series. Once again, I'd like to thank Renee, and of course, I'd like to thank Elan Goldstein for taking the time to talk to us. Until next time, viva la revolution.